Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, October 14th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI, and also available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Sasha Abramsky, author of the new book, The House of 20,000 Books. But first up, author Barry Yorgrau. Barry is the author of books of surreal brief stories, including Wearing Dad's Head, Haunted Traveler, A Man Jumps Out of an Airplane, and The Sadness of Sex, in whose film version he starred. He and his work have appeared on MTV's Unplugged, Spoken Word, and NPR's All Things Considered and Selected Shorts, among others. Barry's fiction has appeared in the Paris Review, Vice, Story, Poetry, Film Comment, and various anthologies. He's written for the New York Times, Spin, Huffington Post, Paris Review Daily, Salon, Independent UK, Art Forum, and elsewhere. He blogs for PsychologyToday.com. His new book is Mess: One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act, which is published by Norton. And I'm so pleased that he's joining us today. Barry, hi there. Welcome to the show.
Nicole, hi. How are you? Good to be here. Good to be there.
Well, let's start by having you introduce the book for us. Could you tell us about Mess?
Yeah, sure. Mess is a memoir. It's my first nonfiction book. I normally write, as you say, as you've noted, fiction. Its title is Mess, One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act. And it's a memoir and a larger study, and it was provoked when a passage I'll read. I had a clutter issue that developed, and I set about having to sort of declutter my place. This was pre-Marie Kondo. I trust you know who I'm talking about, the Japanese art of tidying. And then I also went into a study of, I decided to investigate the larger issues of life with objects. So I spoke to collectors and visited hoarders and clutterbugs, spoke to the leading psychologists in the field of hoarding, went to peer groups. I really went into kind of like a Moby Dick version of the fish that is clutter. And so it was quite an adventure. It took twice as long as I thought it would. But then at last, my book came out in, a couple of months ago now. And there we are.
Well, yes, I'd like to have you read in a moment, but I want to talk also about this. I think time is relative, because this project, you said, started in 2010, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that just, on our show, that's not a huge amount of time. And you have this quote from a pair of psychologists, and it says, "People who hoard are often highly distractible. Their symptoms make it difficult for them to concentrate on a task without being diverted by other things." And you said, "This was me in spades, along with procrastination, disorganization, and indecisiveness." Now, you're a highly accomplished writer, and so I'm wondering how you reconcile this self-image or, you know, this self-destruction with all of your achievements.
It's called the Internet. I really think that has a great deal to do with it. I think Franzen, I'm not very conversant with Jonathan Franzen's work, but he said, I picked up a stray comment he made. I mean, he's a bit extreme, but in a way, he said, no serious work, literary work, can be done in a house with an Internet connection. And I think people are, there was just a piece in the Times about Sven Birkert's, however you say that, about saying that, you know, trying to concentrate in an age of the Internet. And I think that getting broadband actually just exacerbated a problem that, I always had these problems. That's why one of the reasons is I write very short. You know, my fictions are really like, I hate the term flash fictions, but that's what they are. They're very, you know, that's another term for them. They're very short fictions, and so I can get in and get out quickly. Being distractible, being all those things is, it makes it sometimes difficult to say the internet has exacerbated it, but one maneuvers through it in life. It's just the internet has made it much harder. I realize it's so easy when you're bored to just click on and you know, have all of YouTube at your beck and call.
Have you taken any measures during your work time to go offline or?
Yes, prayer. I've resorted to prayer. No, it's. It, you know, the thing is this also, is in doing this book wouldn't have existed really without Google. Because what Google allows you to do, the research I could do without having to move, was just phenomenal. And, for instance, there was one part in the book where I had to throw out, where I wanted to throw out an old exercise machine that sort of looked like a skeletal reindeer, you know, some kind of weird rowing contraption that I had a sentimental attachment to for some reason. And I finally brought myself to throw it out, and I had this made this kind of ceremonial performance, which is one of the things I did in doing the book, to throw it out, and I decided to play a piece of music as a soundtrack for my discarding this exercise machine. And I hit on a Roy Rogers, I found a Roy Rogers Au Revoir song to trigger. So I played that in the background. I was just holding the thing out just for a chuckle, and it sort of, I thought it'd make good copy, as they say. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, is it possible that Roy Rogers himself had a clutter problem? So I rushed to my laptop. I left off the exercise machine. I ran to my laptop and discovered that indeed Roy Rogers was a pack rat. So that kind of instantaneous, I mean, how would I research that, before broadband? I would have, you know, had to go to the library or something. So, you know, that would have taken 2 days. So it's really interesting how I was, you know, and that replicated itself throughout doing this project. I discovered coincidences that I would never have discovered if I wasn't able to sort of go ferreting archivally online. So, you know, there are tremendous positives. I can't imagine doing journalism without, although some people do, without Google, without the internet, but one pays a price for it.
And have you had similar experiences with your fiction where it's been a mixed bag and not just a detriment?
No, how do you mean, the internet?
Yes, the internet.
I think the internet is a complete enemy of my fiction. I don't know how it is for other people. Complete enemy. Because one of the things that happens is, you know, when one works, one always has frustration and anxiety as a component of working. I mean, that's why people scream when they're working sometimes, you know. I do. Just because just putting down a simple sentence can be so difficult and grueling. One of my favorite quotes that I never go to writers' conferences, but one of my favorite quotes that got when I happened to go to a writers' conference many, many years ago, and a writer, I don't know if people know him anymore, named George Garrett, I don't really know his work, but he was this someone who taught a lot in universities, taught a lot of writing classes, and wrote historical novels. But he said something that I thought was just absolutely wonderful, and I repeat it to people. He said, the definition of a writer is someone for whom the act of writing is more difficult than it is for other people. And that labor and intensity, when it's good, it's great, but there's so often you have to sort of grind your wheels, grind your teeth, you know, just grind your mind to come up, to get into the place where you can, where the work starts to flow, and it's so easy to be. You really have to have discipline not to find a way of trying to staunch that anxiety quickly. And you can get such immediate relief on the internet for that stuff. You can immediately just distract yourself, and so writing requires fighting off these distractions to be able to just. Be able to get into the work. So the internet for that, I think, is not good. And I mean, that's why a lot of writing colonies, some at least I understand, ban internet. I've at least heard of a couple. And I think, you know, it's excruciating. One becomes dependent on it, and, you know, but there you are. Who said the writer's life had to be easy, yeah?
Well, let's go back to the beginning of your memoir.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what you're going to read to us.
Uh-huh. I'll read you the opening passage.
Okay, perfect.
Shall I go?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is called Prologue with Grocery Bags. Okay, I'm going to make sure I'm keeping. I have an electronic stopwatch I'm watching. It has a whistle that will blow. No, I'm teasing. That's how it begins, with grocery bags. Grocery bags and the unexpected buzz of the doorbell one afternoon at my apartment writing studio here in Jackson Heights, Queens. At that rasping blurt, my heart seizes in foreboding. "Who is it?" I cry, rising uncertainly from my desk chair. The reply makes my heart dive through the floor. "It's me," cries my girlfriend, Cosima. "Let me in." I have the shock of being caught. "What's up?" I ask when I reach the door and open it a crack. This is the first time in 5 years that Cosima has been at my threshold, though her apartment is just around the block. Her brow and upper lip are beaded with sweat, laden grocery bags strained from both hands. "I forgot my keys at home," she pants, irritable and short-winded. "Let me in, these bags are heavy." I struggle to keep a wild edge out of my voice. "I can't," I reply abruptly. "Why don't you go to your mother's?" Her mother lives 2 flights down from me. "My mother isn't at home," Cosima snaps. "Why can't I come in?" she cries, her voice rising. "Because I don't want you to see what's in here," I tell her savagely through gritted teeth. "You know that, okay?" I can see a look of horror flash in her eyes. She steps back. She's had a glimpse past me. "No, I don't have a crack pipe or a chat room dungeon habit or a dead body. But my condition would provoke alarm, even disgust, in most people. Make that the condition of my apartment. I'm a pack rat, a clutterbug. I have something of a hoarding issue." "Jesus Christ," Cosima says, a stark pause. "Give me your keys," she says tightly. I go and find them, my keys to her place, and bring them to the door. I offer to help her carry her groceries downstairs. "That's all right, don't bother," she answers, laboring off toward the elevator. I watch her go. "I'm sorry," I call after her. I shut the door, numb. I go back to my desk chair and sink down with my heart still pounding. I feel shamed and exposed. Some line has been crossed, a hidden life revealed. For a few minutes, I get up again and go about lamely gathering and throwing out some of the litter of newspapers, magazines, and junk mails adrift on the floor by the entryway. But then I get overwhelmed, and I go back to my laptop, back to resume half working and half surfing, my customary mode, the activity in which I've been interrupted, except that a sick worm is gnawing inside of me. The definition of a troubled or addictive behavior I once read bubbles into my head, not for the first time, here behind my barred door. It's behavior that interferes with your intimate relationships and obligations. Anyway, yeah, that's the, there is the opening passage of my book, Mess, One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act.
Thank you. Yes, that was Barry Yorgrau reading from his new memoir, Mess, One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, Barry, you're the scene, it seems, I'm curious time-wise and in terms of distance, with the beginning, it's almost like, well, it's literally the beginning of your book, but did you know as it was happening that it was your first chapter, or when did you know?
No. What happened was that then there was an ultimatum that followed from my girlfriend that I had to clean up things and also my act, because she knew about my drifting into surfing and stuff, surfing the internet a lot as a, you know, this half working mode. So what happened was I really started to research the project, and it turned out a book called Stuff, which was written by the people who founded the field of hoarding psychology, Randy Frost, mainly, was a co-author, whom I got to know. The stuff was all, I discovered there was a world of hoarding going on. So I wasn't sure what, I figured I have to declutter, and then I decided as I finally, I would make it into a project. Make it into like a larger project, a cleanup project, of my own thing, and then I would investigate the whole problem socially and culturally and historically, the Moby Dick version, as it were, and then I decided I would also have to chronicle it, and it was very scary because in my fiction I am very confessional. People think I'm a fantasist, a fabulist, and a surrealist. I'm very confessional, but I mask it in fantastical and surreal stuff, in the way a dream is a mask. And the idea of having to write a memoir, which was just straight ahead, where I couldn't resort to, you know, something fantastical happening to disguise what was going on, but I had to sort of look directly into the mirror without a mask, was a bit scary, very scary, actually. But that's what I decided I should do, and so it emerged that, you know, this is the place to start it. This is where it kicked off. I mean, I will say this. I mean, one of the things people ask me, and sometimes, you know, I think of myself ultimately having gone through all this stuff as someone who's a clutterbug with hoarding tendencies, because the difference between clutterbugs and hoarders is that someone with a clutter issue is able to let go. They can bring themselves to let go. They can be helped to let go. Whereas people who hoard, you know, the hoarders, that, you know, not just the people you see on the TV shows, but people with just ongoing, you know, not sensationalist hoarding issues, cannot bring themselves to let things go. It's now the lead symptom and all this stuff. So, so it was interesting. So I was able to, you know, maneuver through these distinctions and really learn quite a bit about it.
And you mentioned, you know, disclosing this part of yourself and the honesty involved. Mm. Also tied up with that, I felt, was all of the dialogue. And in the section you read and further on, there was a striking amount of dialogue. How did you, is that just as you recalled it, I assume, or?
Well, you know, look, in memoirs are not, taped interviews that then get simply transcribed. Because if you look at a lot of memoirs that are historical and people have conversations reported, do you really think that people remember exactly what was said at 8 years old to mom at that? You know what I mean? So there's a certain amount of, what do you want to call it, you know, responsible invention in some of this stuff. But having said that, a lot of the discourse, a lot of the conversation gets reported. I did, when I was interviewing outside sources, I taped everything. And in fact, I couldn't include one conversation in the book because the tape recorder malfunctioned and I wasn't taking good enough notes. So I lost something, but it's all right, I made up for another. But in the conversation with my girlfriend, whom I call Cosima, I use, as you know, pseudonyms through the book. I like changing, I even change the pseudonym. I remember that a lot because we enjoy banter. So I can remember, you know, I can remember a lot of what we actually said to each other. And it got to the point where when you're doing a memoir like this or a chronicle, you become so self-conscious, you write everything down. You know what I mean? As a matter of fact, I discovered that doing a project about my decluttering started to interfere with my decluttering. I would leave pieces of... I took enormous amounts of photos to photo document. And I got to the point where dust would gather in one part of my house, and I'd leave it alone because I'd think... No, I want to photograph it in a certain light, and at a certain where am I going to clean it in the narrative that I'm building of this memoir? So it was things get rather complicated. But anyway, the other thing I just want to note in a general way. I think I'm the first person really who wrote about these issues as a sufferer, as well as a researcher and an observer. A lot of the other excellent memoirs that have been written, Jessie Scholl wrote a book, A Dirty Secret, about her mother. A new one is coming out another one is coming out in the winter here in January. But they're all about people who write about a parent or spouse or whatever, about someone else having the problem that they have to live with, like the child of an alcoholic or something. Whereas I think I believe I'm the first person who's really written as someone who actually has, his own clutter issues and is writing about it as, as an observer and a researcher. And it made things a bit complicated sometimes when I went to peer groups I went and hung out with the UK's most extreme hoarder guy. So part of what together I shared I sympathized with someone who was having a problem and was talking about it in a way that I really understood and could relate to in my smaller way. But I also realized I was a reporter looking for snazzy bits of local color and nice narrative turns, you know. And you begin to feel a little, it makes one, you know. Janet Malcolm writes about this really interestingly, where she says, you know, the trouble with these things is that as a reporter you show up and the person thinks, oh, you're there just to serve their agenda and to bring it to the wider world, whereas as a writer you always have your own agenda, which is to make a really compelling, to tell the story in a compelling way. And you know, it doesn't make you the champion of that other person, not necessarily.
And going back to the timeline of this, and I'm curious because it was, you were going through it, you know, there was this interference, as you say, and the immediacy of it in your life with regard to what you're going through with Cosima and everyone else. Do you think the book would have turned out differently if you had written it 10 years from now, looking back on the experience? Or?
Oh, indeed. Completely. Completely. I mean, the famous thing also is one says, you know, it's like I did a little bit of movie work, and we did a movie of one of my books, which I was in, and wrote the script and everything, or whatever passed for a script. And the famous thing you say when you finish a movie, and I think with a book like this too, is like, oh, geez, now I understand how I should do it. You know what I mean? It's like you. It's almost like the actual book is the trial run for the real book. But it's always shifting and changing. So yeah, I'm sure. You know, also there are different insights that the field of hoarding, which is getting so much attention, a lot of it, alas, terribly sensationalist and I think destructive. And there's some psychologists who agree with me and others who think, no, it brings the larger issue into the public eye. But so much of this has, and even in the field of psychology in general, in mental health, there are new frontiers being developed, a lot of them in a reductive and bad way, to use shorthand. But things are in flux, and I think the understanding of hoarding, of what it is that leads people to hoard, is just really being explored deeply. There was no psychological category really for this problem. About 20 years ago, 25. In 1993 was when the first paper was written about hoarding, because it was always just parked under, like, anal retentive, or and then it became part of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and now it's become a full-fledged disorder by itself, although it still occupies as a symptom in some other disorder. It still stands as a symptom for some other disorders. But it's all just evolving, all this stuff, the understanding of it.
I'm talking to Barry Yorgrow. His new memoir is Mess, One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Barry, I heard in an interview that you did at the Strand Bookstore, which is available on YouTube, that you and Cosima considered having a chapter from her point of view. And you didn't end up going that route. But could you talk some more about that decision and the process of considering and, you know, rejecting that idea?
Yeah, no. It was a threatened lawsuit. No. One of the things I really, you know, I'm a comic writer, among other things, so and there were such comic possibilities, and for me it was a way to get into the material and really make it live. And comedy is one of the aspects of life. So, and Cosima, my girlfriend, I must say, is such a rich character. She's written her own memoir, by the way. I mean, she's normally a cookbook writer, but she wrote her own memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union, and it's called Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. That's her book. I won't tell you what her real name is. You can figure it out. But she emerged in such a strong character in the book that I thought it would be fun. I mean, part of the give and take was between the two of us, that I thought it would be a neat coup to have her actually take over, since she was being at various points such a know-it-all, she would actually start taking over the narrative. I thought that would be a great gambit. But then it seemed maybe a little too much. We want to stay, I mean, it's a serious topic, so we want to, you know, we don't want to go that far out. But, the idea to change her, to the comic richness of having her change, her pseudonym being changed through the book, because she kept protesting about what her pseudonym was as things went along, was great fun and helped make the book lively, I think.
Well, Barry, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I would love to ask you if you have any writing advice to share with our writer listeners out there.
Sure. I mean, the writing advice I always share when I think is for me, the whole key in how I, you know, how you write is how I discovered writing was to really find a voice that seemed mine. And the way you do that is you just trust yourself and instead of, you know, writer has to me read a lot. I mean, writing is tremendously about reading a lot. But ultimately, you have to just sort of go with what you have, when you find your voice, that opens up. For years, I figured, what am I going to write about? And when I discovered a voice, when I just, instead of writing one way, I just started writing another way that felt more natural and that felt more engaged, that felt more centered. The material just found itself. The voice discovers the material. So I would say, find your voice. And when people say, well, how do I find my voice? You know, you keep trying. And a way of writing suddenly seems to connect to you in a deep emotional way immediately. And with that immediacy, that's, finding the voice is, I think, the key.
Mm. Well, Barry, thank you so much for being on the show.
Nicole, it's a pleasure.
That was Barry Yorgrau, author of the new memoir, Mess, published by Norton. During the second part of this show, Sasha Abramsky, author of The House of 20,000 Books, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with memoirist Barry Yorgrau. Next up, I'll be speaking with author Sasha Abramsky. Sasha is a freelance journalist. His work has appeared in The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, New York Magazine, Salon, Slate, The New Yorker Online, and Rolling Stone, among other publications. He has a master's degree from Columbia University School of Journalism. His book, The American Way of Poverty, came out in September 2013 and was listed by The New York Times as amongst the 100 notable books of the year. Prior to that, he published Inside Obama's Brain, Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It, American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment, Cond, and Hard Time Blues. His latest book, a biography, is titled The House of 20,000 Books and is published by New York Review of Books. I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Sasha.
Good morning, Nicole. How are you?
Oh, doing great. Thank you. To start us off, could you introduce The House of 20,000 Books to us and tell us what it's about?
Yeah, The House of 20,000 Books was the house that my grandparents, Mimi and Shimon Abramsky, lived in North London. And the address was 5 Hillway. And it was this remarkable house. My granddad was a rare books collector, and he had two passions. He collected socialist history, and he collected Jewish history. And he had this vast number of books and manuscripts, documents, posters, letters, that over the course of the nearly 70 years he lived there, came to define the house. And my grandmother was this extraordinary hostess, and she opened the house up so there were always a huge number of people sitting around the dining room table discussing ideas. So it was just this sort of wonderland of ideas. And when my grandparents died, or when my granddad died in 2010, I decided that I wanted to bring that house back to life, that I wanted to create a literary monument to their house. So that's what the House of 20,000 Books is.
Yes, just looking at the cover, it's such an inviting picture. You just want to enter into that world.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always been absolutely mesmerized by the world of books. And to me, a house is incomplete without books. And so if I enter a house and it's absolutely clean and there's no books anywhere and no piles of written materials anywhere, it seems sterile to me. Whereas if I enter a house that is a house where you can see books and touch books and smell old paper and old parchment or old vellum, to me, that's a house where you can see the soul of the people who live in the house.
Mm. And I mentioned in the intro that you have a master's in journalism, and you've published several books on various current topics. So when your grandfather died and you decided to write this personal story, how was that? What was that, a different experience, and how was the process different?
It was so different because for the last 20 years, I've been writing on social justice themes and basically exploring inequalities and inequities and the way they play out across the country. And so I've immersed myself going to all corners of the country, doing reporting and trying to construct stories of the lives lived on the margins. And this is a completely different project. This is absolutely personal. It's as intimate a piece of writing as certainly as I have ever done, but I suspect as I ever will do. And it's something that absolutely spoke from my heart. It was about people who I love dearly, and it was about a place that I love dearly, and it was about ideas that were just so important to me, this incredibly contentious place where nothing was barred. You were expected to engage in great conversation. And so as I wrote this book, I really felt I was living with people who, in fact, had been long dead, but I was living with a series of ghosts, and I was having conversations with them, and ultimately I was even dreaming about them, and I was dreaming about the place. And the book is constructed around the different rooms of the house and the different ideas contained in each room and the different configurations of people who would gather in each room. And so as I was writing it, I was having to really bring back to life in the most intense way possible the feeling of the house and literally conjuring up all the memories of which book was where and which painting was where and which group of people were drinking wine or tea in which room in which year. And it was this incredibly intimate voyage, and it was a learning experience for me. It was a learning experience both about the ideas contained in the book, but also at the end of the day, it became a voyage of discovery for me. It became a sort of meditation on meaning and on life and death for me. And it became this sort of very, very personal, philosophical, and meditative piece of writing. And it was a very interesting experience to write it.
I'm talking to Sasha Abramsky. His latest work is The House of 20,000 Books. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And is it the right category to call it a biography, or what do you like to categorize it as?
You know, it's funny. It's a question that I wrestled with, and I know my publishers also wrestled with, because it is a biography about my grandparents, but it's also a memoir about my childhood, and it's also a journey through the 20th century, which makes it a history. It's a journey from the pogroms in the Russian Empire at the turn of the 19th, early 20th century, all the way through to these great political debates in mid-century London, and then right down into the 21st century. So it's a historical journey as well. And then the other way I'd categorize it is wherever you'd put Blue Highways or Then and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, that's probably also a place you ought to find my book, because it really is a sort of personal meditation as well.
Sasha, would you read to us from your book?
I'd love to, and let me presage about the way I constructed the book. Each chapter is set in a different room. So my grandparents' bedroom, for example, was where all of his rarest socialist and Marxist documents were, letters written by Karl Marx or by Trotsky or by Lenin, William Morris woodcuts and so on. The upstairs front room was where rare Judaica was, Bomberg Bibles printed in Hebrew in the 16th century, first edition Spinozas and so on. So what I thought I'd do is read a passage that begins in my grandparents' bedroom and that ends up downstairs in the kitchen. And it takes you really through the texture of the house. So I'll start now. For an adult to be invited into Shimon's bedroom signified not romantic interest, nor coy flirtation, but academic trust. You had to earn your way in, show knowledge of or love for socialism and its lost worlds, or at the very least, the esoteric universe of rare manuscript and book collecting. You had to appreciate the sensation of touching a book that Marx had owned and commented on, or a document on which Lenin had scribbled marginalia. You had to have a capacity to comprehend the absurdly low probability of Marx's membership card for the First International, not only surviving for more than 100 years, but finding its way to Hillway, or a scrip printed by the 19th century utopian socialist Robert Owen as an alternative currency ending up in this room. There was, recalled one friend, a touch of the impresario to Shimon, a magician's delight in surprising you. He'd trot off to a room and return with something and enjoy a reaction. A cousin recalled first being shown the room in 1978, about 20 years after he had first visited the house, and Shimon wistfully asking him where he thought these books would be in 100 years. He wasn't so much talking about where the books would be physically, he was talking about where the ideas would be. But the grandchildren did not have to earn entry to this citadel. It was simply where we slept at Hillway, when we were too young and scared to sleep alone. It smelled old and musty, and I was never quite sure whether that was the smell of the books or of my grandparents. Later on, I would sleep in the small room that was kitty corner to their bedroom, a little room with a twin bed and a set of cabinets that contained some of my aunt's bric-a-brac from when she lived with her parents, bracketed to the wall over the far side of the bed. By the windows was a cupboard, in which were stacked mountains of catalogs and other research materials that Shimon would use when evaluating rare books and manuscripts for Sotheby's. Sandwiched between the cupboard and the bedroom door in this little spare room hung two low-grade copies of Marc Chagall paintings. When I stayed there overnight as a teenager, I would wake up and look at those paintings in the early morning light. And then, at a leisurely pace, I would get out of bed, brush my teeth, shower in the impossibly weak stream of water from the handheld nozzle in the bathroom that had not been updated since the Second World War, and head downstairs. Above the bend in the staircase hung the huge, but still only one-third the size of the original, ghoulish, mass-produced black-and-white reproduction of Guernica, the mutilated, howling faces and bodies of the Spanish city's experience with aerial bombardment standing a somber testament to the horrors of the modern world. It was those horrors that had convinced my grandmother to cast her lot with the Communist Party. I would hurry past the painting, down the moth-eaten carpet on the stairs as fast as possible. At the bottom, I would execute a U-turn by swinging around the banister's angular knob and head down the hallway toward the kitchen. There, I knew, my grandmother would be standing by the stove, a pan full of eggy pancakes waiting for me, a hot cup of tea ready to be gulped down, a pot of warmed honey for dripping on the pancakes on the table near my seat. "Hello, love," she would say. "I made you some breakfast."
That was Sasha Abramsky reading from his new book, The House of 20,000 Books. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Thank you for that. And so as you mentioned, in that scene and in the book, it's structured so we move from room to room. And I was wondering, in terms of, you know, sitting down to write the book, was that structure obvious to you from the get-go, or did you entertain other ways to organize the material?
You know, when my granddad died, and he only died in 2010, so he was alive until I was 38, and I knew that I was going to write about his life one day, because he was this absolutely larger-than-life character, and he wore so many different hats, and he intersected with history so actively, and he knew so many extraordinary people. You could find people like Isaiah Berlin in that house, or Eric Hobsbawm, or the historian Christopher Hill, or Rabbi Arthur Herzberg, just these wondrously interesting people. And it was a lost world. I knew that when he died, the sensibility that went along with that house would largely die with him. And I always knew that it was worth preserving and that it was worth a story worth telling, but I didn't know how I was going to tell the story. And so after Shimon died, I started researching. I started interviewing people who had gone through that house from the 1940s all the way through to the present. And I started going into archives and looking up old letters and looking up Communist Party things that Shimon had written back in the 40s and 50s and looking up academic correspondence and so on. But I didn't know how I was going to frame it. And I can't remember exactly when, but there was at some point during the early research, I suddenly realized, and it really was just a sort of flash of light, I suddenly realized the central character of this story was the house itself, and that the house oozed so much personality and had so much charm and contained so much that I could structure a narrative much more effectively if I used the house as the central character. And once I had that realization, it really started falling into place, because then I could tell a chronological story, because Shimon organized his books vaguely by category, and he collected different things at different times. So if I started organizing it room by room, I could start constructing a biography of Shimon and Mimi that would journey through time more effectively. And I could start linking together all these disparate ideas that Shimon had somehow conjured into a coherent narrative of history. So I could sort of go from Maimonides in the late 12th century through to Spinoza in the 17th century. And then I could make a jump to the English liberal philosophers, John Locke and so on. And then I could jump into the French Revolution, and from there into Marxism in the 19th century and the various revolutionary movements that followed on from that. And it suddenly started to make sense. And so I don't think I've ever had a sort of flash like that before, where suddenly in the middle of a writing process, it became clear to me how I was going to tell the story. But that certainly happened in this project.
Mm. And in terms of gaining access to this wonderful collection that Shimon had, I understand that he had a process. You had to follow a bit of a protocol to gain access.
Well, very informally. There was no admissions process, but Shimon basically wanted to make sure that if you if you wrote to him or phoned him or approached him at a very institution and said, look, I want to come to your collection, he wanted to make sure you had a genuine interest in ideas. And as soon as you did, if he had a conversation with you and just felt this was somebody who cared about whether it was Yiddish novels in the 19th century or Bundist political pamphlets or Rare Judaica or Marxism, whatever it was, if you had that interest, he would invite you to the house and he would give you a cup of tea or coffee and he would let you look at the books. He would take them off the bookshelves and he would trust you to look at them. And then if he liked you, you'd be invited back, and fairly soon Mimi would start cooking for you. And once you were invited to the dining room table, that was an open admission ticket. You were never persona non grata after that. You could show up day or night, you could ring the doorbell and you'd be welcomed into the house. And so that was the sort of vague admission process into Hillway. But the other thing was they ran it as an entirely open house for friends and family. So they had very large extended families. They had friends all over the world. They had academic colleagues and professional colleagues from all over the world. And then they had these different generations. First, my father and his sister would invite their friends into the house. And then when I was young, I and my brother and sister and my cousins, the grandchildren, we would all invite our friends into the house. And so the house was always filled with people, and even as Mimi and Shimon got older, the house stayed full of life because they always made sure to bring in fresh blood. And so it was chaotic, and it was full of clutter, and it was absolutely magical in terms of the experience you could have when you were there.
Mm. You describe in the book the modest selection of items from the collection that you selected to keep. And I was wondering if you could talk some more about what it was like deciding on which books you wanted to hold on to.
Well, for me, I was never going to, in any way, shape, or form, become a collector of books, because that's not who I am. I do buy a lot of books, and I read a huge amount of books, but I'm not, by temperament, a collector of rare books in the way that Shimon was. But when I was growing up, his socialist collection and his politics and his philosophy always fascinated me. And there was one set of books in the living room downstairs at about eye level for a young kid. And it was a set of books called the Everyman Classics. And the Everyman Publishing Project was this incredibly democratic, almost utopian publishing project from the early 20th century. And the idea was that you could take all the great classics and you could mass produce them cheaply and affordably in a pocket-size edition. And the point of it being in a pocket-size edition was that it could be bought by a working man or woman, could be put into their pocket, and could be taken out and read on the London Underground at rush hour. And there was something that always fascinated me about that publishing venture. And so even though those books, they were fairly commonplace, and they certainly weren't rare, they always made a huge impact on me. And Shimon had in that collection, he had Plato and Aristotle, he had Marx, he had John Locke, he had Macaulay. He had this fabulous selection of writers and thinkers. And so when Shimon died, I did ask my parents, I said, look, I don't want a huge number of books, but the Everyman Classics is something I do want because it means so much to me. And you can construct a whole, it's almost like a seed bank. You can build up all these great ideas from those foundational texts. And so I have them in my office in my house in California now, and every so often I take one off my shelf and I browse through it and I look at Shimon's marginalia comments. It makes me feel very, very happy.
I'm talking to Sasha Abramsky. His latest work is The House of 20,000 Books. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And I'm wondering about fiction in Shimon's collection. You mentioned earlier some Yiddish novels, but I don't recall fiction playing a huge part in his collection. But could you talk some more about his relationship with fiction?
Yeah, in actual fact, I think my grandmother, Mimi, read more fiction, and she did not collect books. Her family had owned a bookstore in the East End of London, a Jewish bookstore called Shapira Valentine. And that's actually how Mimi and Shimon had met. Shimon had applied for work there and started working at Shapiro Valentine and met Mimi, and they got married. So Mimi had grown up in the world of books, but she herself wasn't a collector, but she did love novels. And so some of the books in that house included Dickens and included other 19th century English novelists. I suspect Shimon didn't read many novels in English. He certainly read novels in Russian, he read novels in Hebrew, and he read novels in Yiddish. And I think that those were the languages he'd grown up with as a child. He'd grown up in Minsk, in Belarusia, and in Moscow. And I think he was most comfortable at a very elementary level with novels in Hebrew and in Russian. And so he did have novels by people like Cy Agnon and Hebrew poets like Bialik. But he didn't have very many English novels. And I wrestled with that when I was trying to work out why. And I ended up concluding that he probably dreamt in Yiddish or in Russian. And I think the language that you dream in is probably the language you tell stories in. And so even though most of his academic materials, his histories, his politics, and so on, mostly were in English, the novels in that house tended to be in other languages.
And he had, it seems, a letter from Voltaire?
That's one of the mysteries of the house. He had letters from many, many people, both letters that he'd been in correspondence with, people like Isaiah Berlin, for example, with whom he'd shared a 40-year correspondence. But he also had letters that he'd collected at auctions or in rare books dealers. And we found, for example, letters by Turgenev, the Russian novelist Turgenev. And we found letters by the British philosopher Bertrand Russell, handwritten letters. And they were just these wondrous letters. But one of the things we didn't find, and I'm not quite sure if it ever existed or not, Shimon hinted in certain correspondence that he had at one point owned a letter written by the French philosopher Voltaire. And, you know, when the house was cleared, there were these huge old roll-top desks, and they had hidden drawers in them. And there were these filing cabinets, again, with hidden drawers. He sort of secreted places. He secreted things in different places. And so in my book, I say, look, we just never found out whether or not there was a letter by Voltaire in the house. But given Shimon's collecting, it's more than plausible. And it's also plausible that it was stuck in the back of a desk somewhere and it ended up in a junk shop, and that somebody who reads my book is going to look into a desktop that they bought in London in 2010 or 11 and find taped to one of the drawers a letter by Voltaire. So it's one of the great unknowns about Five Hill Way.
Wow. So, Sasha, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I need to ask you if you have any writing advice for the writers listening, maybe about structure and finding.
Well, I have a few pieces of advice, and I do teach a lot of young aspiring writers at University of California in Davis, and I always tell them that before you can be a good writer, you have to be a good reader. And what I mean by that is that you have to both read voraciously about anything and everything. You have to let your curiosity run rampant. But you also have to read carefully. You have to read with an editorial eye, and you have to look at how great writers construct sentences and narratives. And you have to think about how they use words and the importance of precision in using words. So that would be my first thing, is just always, always, always be curious about the world around you and the world of ideas. But in terms of the actual writing process, I would say that the first thing you have to do is let your guard down before you start talking about structure and before you start talking about skeletal outlines or all these other things that are important in the process. The very first thing you have to do is almost stream of consciousness, that you have to just let your mind go where it will and explore a problem or a topic or a subject in any way, shape, or form that your mind chooses to go. And then once you've done that, once you've gone on a sort of peregrination through the brambles on the side of the whole process, then you can start editing out, and then you can start working out the structure, and then you can start doing all the things that you're told in classic writing classes. You need a skeletal outline, you need to think about punctuation and paragraphs, all the mechanical stuff. Beyond that, you need to think about how do you add a personal, authorial voice? How do you add individualism to your writing? Because pretty much anybody can create a skeletal outline and a series of bullet points around a set of ideas. But not anybody can then flesh all those ideas out and individuate them and use language in a way that puts your personal stamp on it. And I do think that to be a good writer, you have to have the confidence to take chances with the language. We've got an incredible rich vocabulary, and we should use it to the full. And we should describe events and people with as much specificity as possible, not in order to overburden an audience, but simply so as to make the events and the people being described realistic. And so that's the advice that I would give young writers. Be confident, be wide-ranging, and trust your authorial voice.
And that all applies so nicely, whether regardless of someone's writing fiction or nonfiction.
I think that's true. And, you know, in actual fact, a lot of the best fiction writing uses the techniques of journalism and of history and of observation. A writer like John Steinbeck, for example, is always using the techniques of observation that he developed while he was a journalist. And I think the reverse holds true as well, that if you're going to write good, compelling nonfiction narratives for a general interest audience, you can do a whole bunch worse than reading really, really good novelists as a way of getting some hints about technique and method.
Mm. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been an absolute joy. Thank you for having me on.
That was author Sasha Abramsky. His book, The House of 20,000 Books, is published by New York Review of Books. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Marie or Barbara will be back. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.